Right, let's begin then. Let's all bring our palms together to make our sincerest veneration to the Buddha, to the Dhamma and the Sangha. Let us take a moment to observe the precepts and seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. As we engage in this wonderful act of reverence, let us remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our obeisance or our piety, but this is more a pledge of allegiance that we take to the truth, ultimate bliss, and the practice that we must all engage in. With that in mind, let us take this moment to observe the precepts and seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. Let us also make use of this opportunity to invite countless sentient beings in the 10,000 world systems out there. And as we do so, let us remind ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, friends of ours, siblings. In one way or another, they will all have come into our lives and have made it better for it. This is our opportunity to repay a debt of gratitude to all of them. So with all that in mind, let us now commence today's proceedings by chanting the Namaskara, seeking refuge and observing the five precepts. Please repeat all together and with me.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
In a recent talk at the monastery during Guru Hamdra's absence, I explained to the gathering of devotees, the Ingirians, shall we say? You are the Rajagirians. Together you are the Yatagirians. On account of what we have to do to help you realize freedom from suffering. Yeah? Yatagirians. That's what we have to do. So in a recent talk, I explained to them the standard that I expect. There you go. Supadeva. So if that was your phone, would you please mind setting it on silent? So I recently explained to them the standard that I expect from an individual who claims to want Nibbana. So there's a certain caliber of individual for whom this is within reach. And what the Dhamma is truly there for. And I explained it to them by using an analogy. And I will share that with you today. It was just on the spot, but I thought to myself, that's a great way to express the kind of individual that I expect you to be. If you are telling me that you are dead serious about Nibbana, and if you are here because you want Nibbana, this is the kind of person for whom Nibbana becomes a reality. What is that kind of person? Let me tell you. I said if ever one would come up to you and spit in your face, it's one of the lowest forms of treatment that you can expect from someone, right? They can tell you off, they can shout at you, scream at you, use offensive language. But then there's not much more that is less than, or more undermining and more disrespectful than, what? To spit in someone's face? Not in any other part of your body, on your face. If someone were to come up to you and spit on your face, I expect you to not retaliate and not react in any other way besides using your left hand, not the right, using your left hand to wipe that spit off of your face. Not the right hand, the left. That is the only response I expect from you. So then, of course, there's a question in the audience. You're all thinking, why is it the left hand? Why not the right? It's not the right because a few moments after they have spat in your face, perhaps just a few moments after, it's still in the heat of the moment, they realize that they need a favor from you. They need something from you. Perhaps they need your help, a helping hand. And so they walk back up to you and say, hey, you know, I know I just spat in your face and all that, but would you mind just giving me a hand with something? Can you just like forget and consider that just water under the bridge and let's move on as friends? And then they extend their right hand to you as an expression of they're trying to, shall we say, reconcile that friendship. You must always have your right hand ready to shake hands with that individual. Whereas if you used your right hand to wipe that spit off of your face, and then you extend your hand to shake hands with them, what's going to happen? That spit is going to get onto their hand. Who spit? Their spit. Serves them right, one might say. But no. That's not what I expect from those who call themselves dharmishta. This is the standard of righteousness that I expect. That is where I want you to be. It will not be easy. Because usually when someone does something to you, something you don't like, it is our intuition. It is almost our instinct. Instinctively, we want to do something back to them, retaliate, an eye for an eye. That is the kind of nature that we are. But if you are of that sort of temperament, the Dhamma won't do much. The Dhamma needs fertile ground to take root, ladies and gentlemen. Have you heard in Sinhalese there's a pair of words, it's a phrase, and permit me to use that in this sermon, given that it's a Sinhalese phrase. Suddha Buddha. We say Suddha Buddha Kalladan. Right? Suddha Buddha. Suddha is to clean. Buddha is to make pure. One removes the dirt, the other purifies. It's not Buddha Suddha, is it? It's not that way, is it? It's not Buddha Suddha. It's Suddha Buddha. So the precursor to Buddha is what? Suddha. Suddha must always come before Buddha. Meaning your heart should be pure Your heart should be clean, should be willing to forgive, should be prepared to forgive, and never have an attitude of retaliation. This is far easier said than done. I know this because I had to go through this experience of growing out of my intrinsic behavior, my intuitions, my instinct, my instinctive behavior. I had to grow out of it. It's not easy to begin with, because to do Suddha, you have to be patient. That's why they say patience is a virtue. You have to be very patient. Think of it. Try to visualize that situation. Someone comes and spits in your face and even calls your name and say you and spit in your face. And at that moment, usually your response is almost reflexive. Response is to fight back, pull at their hair, throw something at them, hit them, attack them, or spit back at them. This is the kind of thing you see in films. And when people fight, this is what you see, right? But you cannot be like that if Nibbana is what you're here for. Because that goes completely and entirely against the kind of person you need to be for the seed of Nibbana to take root. Think of the Bodhisattva. You've read the Paramita stories, the Jataka stories, at least a few of them. You've heard them. Every time someone would walk up to them and leave them in adversity, treat him with adversity, he never retaliated. Because there was one thing he always wanted. I shall bear this, I shall tolerate this. He's only doing this because, or she's only doing this because he or she is hurt. For my sake and for their sake, I shall become a Buddha and help them come out of this torment, this hurt, this pain, this anguish that they're going through, which is a cause for their behavior towards me. See, it is a Bodhisattva who always becomes a Buddha, ladies and gentlemen. Please remember that, please understand that. Before you become a Buddha, there are three types of Buddhas. Sammasam Buddha, Paccheka Buddha and Arahatta Buddha. Meaning there are three types of Bodhisattvas. Aren't there? Has to be. There are the Sammasam Buddha Bodhisattvas. Then there are the Paccheka Buddha Bodhisattvas. And then there are the Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattvas. Not Tirisansattvas. Not Manusattvas. Not Devasattvas, they are Bodhisattvas. You tell me that you want to become Arahants. Do you? That is what this series of sermons is for. Exclusively for aspirants of Nibbana. You know you're not here for anything else. Even if you are, you know I'm not here for anything else. I would not get out of bed for anything else. Let alone leave the monastery for anything else. I'm here for our Nibbana, yours and mine. My Nibbana is no better than your Nibbana, yours is no better than my Nibbana. If I was selfish, I could just stay back at the monastery and just, you know, be among my noble friends, be with my teacher. He's out of the monastery now more so than he used to. So while he's at the monastery, where do you think I should be? Just the other day he was saying he'll be going out again soon. I think in a couple of weeks' time. And then he says the following the next year he's going to be out more so than he used to be, or he used to in the last year. So then the opportunity that I have to be with him, where do you think I should be? With him. That is, he's the reason I came to the sasana, for my Nibbana of course, but I wanted a teacher to get that done, and now my teacher is here. So if I'm sane enough, that's what I ought to be. Or that's where I ought to be. So why am I here? Because I like the fame. I'm here for your pirikara. I'm here for Nibbana. That's what I'm here for. Because when you tell me that you want to become arahants, I believe you. I hope you're not lying. Are you? When you walk up to me and tell me, Nayakanandro, Swami no answer, please would you accept this and deliver us from samsara? Please would you preach the truths, show us the path, guide us towards Nibbana, because we, just as much as you, wish to become arahants. I believe you. I trust you. Or have you got me fooled? Hope not. Therefore I'm here. Because your Nibbana and my Nibbana, to me, they're equal. So then, if you want an arahathood, if arahathood is what you aspire to, ladies and gentlemen, it's only an arahat bodhisattva who becomes an arahat. So what are the makings of an arahat bodhisattva? That is the most important question to ask. What are the makings of an arahat bodhisattva? You know, let's put aside Samma Sambuddha Bodhisattva. Right? Anyone interested in that? You might as well leave the room, because that's not going to happen in this era. Paccheka Buddha Bodhisattvas, my help is not going to be of any use to you, because you have to achieve that on your own. So the only ones who have to remain here, really, are the Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattvas. Agreed? Okay. So if we have then a room full of Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattvas, what are the makings of an Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattva? What are the characteristics? What are the virtues? What are the qualities of an Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattva? And do you possess them? Have you instilled those values? This is the test. This is why I have just described to you one of their characteristics. If someone were to spit in your face, never use the right hand, because the next moment they might need your help. And they might need you to extend your hand so that they can grab yours and rise up, because they have fallen. Therefore, always use your left hand. Wipe that spit and then put it behind your back until you have an opportunity to wash your hand. Must they fetch the water for you? Must they fetch the water for you? Is that a demand that you are going to make? No, no, no. If they wish to offer some water to you, let them. Only if they do it happily, then let them. But that is not a demand of yours. So you understand the analogy now, right? That was just an analogy. Now apply that into the various walks of your life, the various situations, scenarios that you come across in life. Think about this. Use that analogy and apply it into the various experiences, scenarios, situations that you have in life. Are you still short-tempered? Do you still have a short fuse? Do you bite? Do you have claws? Do you just grow them, you know, just in sake, just in case? Huh? Just in case I might need them. Wow. Animalistic tendencies. We've got to put them all aside. That must all go away. We have to wash them away, ladies and gentlemen. Anuttaram punyakyattang is where your Dhamma starts. That's where the seed can be planted. Because when we first walk in, it's just a thick jungle. All sorts of animals. This is the mind I'm talking about. The mind is just a jungle of all sorts of animals. In there you will find foxes, tigers, jackals, vultures, bears, big grizzly bears. Right from those beasts to little insects like termites and ants. All of that. Ugly earthworms. All of that you will find in your mind as you first take your first steps. If you try to cultivate anything on that soil, nothing's going to work. It just won't happen. The effort that you put in is not going to be worthwhile. Therefore, the first thing that you have to do is to clear out the thicket. Clear it out. Let the sun fall. Let the sun rays fall. Let the sunlight fall. So you've got to chase away all those demons, all those dragons that you have in your mind. One of these dragons, one of these animals is, if you hurt me, I will hurt you and I will remember it till the end of time. Sometimes you don't say it, but that is the attitude that people tend to have. Do you still hold grudges? Do you? I don't know. Ask yourself. Are there still people who you would rather not come across? People who you would never consider helping? Are there people who you want to teach a good lesson? Two. Are there people who've hurt you and now they have wounded you in such a way that you just can't, the scabs of the wound never disappear. It's always there. Just the sight of them, the thought of them, the sound of them. And the pain of the wound appears again and you are reminded of all that they did to you. And when given the opportunity, you attack. Sometimes verbally, perhaps not physically anymore because we are civilized, but verbally, silently, diplomatically. Someone's hurt you some time ago and now you see that they're trying to apply to the company in which you work. Do you slowly walk up to the boss? Or the recruitment department and say, that guy, he's no good. But why? He's got the qualifications. Nah, he's no good. Don't take him. Trust me, take my word, but don't take that guy. And then you cook up a story, make up tales, just so that you can take your revenge. You still take revenge? Don't nod. I don't need your nod. Not inside, either this way or that way. Not to yourself. Do you still take revenge? Do you have a list of people to whom you want to teach a lesson before you die? You know those must-see movies before you die? Must teach a lesson before I die? Is there another list? It's okay if you're like that, it's just that Nibbana won't work for you. That's all I have to say on that matter. Nibbana won't work for you. So for your sake, if not theirs, ladies and gentlemen, it is high time that you make yourselves better. Better yourselves. Let go of all that. Put that dirt linen to a side. Take it off, put it to a side. Cast it away and start afresh. But I know that this is difficult. I know this is difficult. But what is difficult is only difficult until you try. And because it's difficult, we have the Dhamma. The Dhamma is here to help you do it, to achieve it. One Saturday I explained to our people, the Dhamma, but why? Why do you need the Dhamma? The Dhamma is not just something we have to study. The Dhamma is here because we have problems to solve. We feel greed, we feel lust, we feel anger, we feel resentment, we feel disappointments. We still feel that if someone attacks, then I must attack back. I must fight back. If you still feel that, then the Dhamma is here to help. If you don't have any of these, then you don't need the Dhamma. So the Dhamma is like medicine. It is medicine, really, to the wounded mind. So if the mind is wounded, then that's what the Dhamma is here for. I will share the Dhamma with you today as well, just as I do every other day. But I need you to understand why the Dhamma. So if you are that kind of person who, when someone spits in your face, you can wipe it off with your left hand so that you keep your right hand always clean, so that you can shake hands with them and move on. If you're that kind of person, but you know it's difficult to do, you know that that's not what your inside of you is burning when you do that, it's very difficult to do that. You know it's the right thing, but the right thing is not always easy to do. Right? It's difficult, it's very challenging. Then I have the Dhamma to help make it easier for you. So there's a fire. First you must decide that you want to put the fire out. Then I will give you the extinguisher. If you don't want to put the fire out, why bother with the extinguisher? What is the Dhamma? The fire extinguisher. You must first be decided that you want to put out this fire once and for all. What are these fires? The fires of daily life, right? Fires of desire. Fires of lust. You walk into the kitchen and there's something cooking and you want to take some of it and put it, stick in your mouth for no reason at all. That's a fire. The fire on the cooker is easier to put out than the fire that rises in your mind when you see something's cooking, when you smell something nice is on the cooker and you want to have a bit of that when there's no really real need, reason or need for you to have it. When you open the fridge to get out the milk, but in the fridge is also something else. What that something else, only you know. Because it's something for everyone. Whatever it is, that something for you is the something that you have in the fridge somewhere. So you take the milk out to make your tea, but also the other thing comes out at the same time. Why? That is because of the fire of desire. If you want to put out that fire, I have the fire extinguisher. If you still have a list of people with whom you have a grudge, people who you feel did wrong to you, and today you are not happy with them, you will not look at them, you will not smile at them, and even if you do, you can't put a real proper smile. You have to fake a smile in their presence. Because the thought of them, the sight of them still hurts. If you are that person, then I have the fire extinguisher, if you want to put that fire out. But if you want to keep that fire, if you want to keep nurturing that fire, right? If you want to be the way you are, then there's no use of a fire extinguisher. Some people, they want to hold on to their anger. I don't know if you've come across people like that. That is the fuel that keeps them going, their anger. They identify themselves with their anger or by their anger. It is part of their identity. I'm the angry one. Like the Buddha is the perfect one. He's the angry one. Sometimes because of their inferiority. They know they're no good in any other way. If they think that they're no good in any other way, then what they tend to do is become the angry one. Because that's easy to do, isn't it? To be the angry one. It's difficult to be the smartest one, difficult to be the kindest one, difficult to be the most gentle one or the most generous one, but to be the angriest one, that's easy. Dogs are there like that. The angriest dog, the most ferocious dog. So there are some who maintain that, because that's me, I'm the angry one. You're not that, are you? Good. So it's difficult to preach to them, it's difficult to give them or show them the fire extinguisher because they don't want it. They don't want it. But you're here because you're here for a different purpose. So I have the Dhamma to you. I will give you the Dhamma. I will share the Dhamma with you. Because you come here and you promise me, Swami Nahasa, we are Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattvas. We wish to be Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattvas. We are Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattvas and we practice that Bodhisattva Paramita. Dana, Sila, Nekkama, Panya, Virya, Kanti, Satcha, Adhitthana, Metta, Upekka. These are the paramitas. Without them, not a snowball's chance in hell that one can become an Arahatta Buddha, ladies and gentlemen. Dana. Wow. Dana is no easy thing. See, Dana and Dhima are two different things. Dana, Dhima is to give. I give to you is Dhima. Dana is I let go. And no longer consider that it was my gift to you. Because typically when you give something to someone, you check, you go back and check whether they use it. You go back and check that whether they use the one that you gave them. You go back and check that they haven't given it to someone else. Because it has some sentimental value. So if they value you, then surely they must value the object that you have gifted them, right? So it must be in their possession. Sometimes you become their biggest headache after you give something to someone. I mean, it's typical around the Aurudu time. Because you take this Aurudu, Kavili and so on, you go places. Right? Just imagine you bake a cake at home. Right? You're the only one who bakes that cake in the entire neighborhood. You bake that cake, that's your signature cake. You bake that cake and you give it to your neighbor. Okay? Around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, you have some people, some other neighbors come in. And guess what they bring with them? Guess what they bring with them? The cake that you baked. That was not available in the shops. The only place it could have come was from your oven. And you only gifted it to gifted to your neighbor. And now it's gone the rounds. And it's come back to you. You tell me, ladies and gentlemen, what kind of emotions do you have at that time? Do you go, Ane, sadhu, sadhu? Is that how you feel? Maybe, I don't know. Perhaps you are like that now. But typically, that's not how someone responds to something like that. The first thought that crosses your mind is, how ungrateful they are. Huh? Especially if when you gave it to them, you explain the whole, you know, all the effort that you had to put into bake it, right? How you read the recipe, you tried it at home, and this is the 10th time, and it worked out just right this time round, and how they are so special to you, and that's why you are going to give this to them, and you haven't given it to anyone else, right? So it came with the full instruction manual, the cake, right? And then excitement, they accepted it from you and they couldn't thank you enough for that, and they said how grateful they are to have received it from you. And then, without a slice missing, it comes back. I mean, if half of it came back, you could make your mind up. But the whole cake comes back. What do you feel like doing with that cake now? Don't you feel like visiting your neighbor again? Only this time, not to serve it to them, but give them a serving of it. See, that is not dana. That is dhima. That is dhima. Meaning, it's like flying a kite. You fly the kite, but the string is always in your hand. So you've not truly given freedom to the kite to fly, have you? You decide where the fly, where the kite can go, how high the kite can go, how far the kite can fly. You decide that because you're the, you still got the string in your hand. That is dhima. Dana is what? Let go. That is the paramita. How many dhanas have you given by this point in your life? The real answer is hardly any. Very few and far between do you find someone actually giving a dana. Typically it's a dhima. I give, but with strings attached. That's the difference. Giving with strings attached and giving with no strings attached. What becomes the paramita is giving without strings attached. That is the Arahatta Buddha paramita. But if you want the Sakviti Raja paramita, that's it. That, for that you just give. Give with strings attached. If you want to become the richest person in the world. One day you want to become the richest person in the world. Give with strings attached, no problem. You want to become an emperor. You want to become a wheel-turning monarch. Sakviti Raja. Or you want to become the Sakradevendra. The Lord Sakra. Ruler of four heavenly abodes. Then give with strings attached. You want to be born beautiful in your next birth. This time now didn't work out, but next time now. you want to be born with good looks. Then give with strings attached, because that is the string that is attached, expecting something in return. May I have for this? It's very difficult, ladies and gentlemen, to do this, I tell you. Honestly, it's very, very, very difficult to do this. If nothing else, you'll usually expect at least a smile in exchange for what you give. Maybe even a thank you. Sometimes you give something to someone and you wait. Okay? All right? And they're like, why are you still waiting? Oh, no, are you okay with that? I mean, are you happy with that? Yeah, I'm good. Okay, then. See, catch yourself when you do this. You all start somewhere, right? So you give something to someone and you're waiting for them to say the magic word. Yeah, you see, it feels like you're anchored to where you are. You can't move until you hear that word. And then you check. Because you're trying to prompt them, but not you don't want to say thank you. That's not nice, right? You want it to be genuine. Right? So you don't say, come on, say thank you, I gave you something. Instead, what do? You say, is it good? Do you like it? Is it nice? Are you sure you want it? Do you want me to exchange it for you something else? A bunch of questions. Hoping that you might just be able to extract a thank you from them. I mean, if you don't like it, you can exchange it for something else, right? It's fine. I know, sometimes you do it genuinely because you really mean it. If you don't want it, you can exchange it for something else. Sometimes, you give them slack. You just say, you don't have to think that I'm going to be watching out and making sure that you keep this. If you want, please feel free to exchange it for something else, right? Because I'm not going to come back and check whether you've kept what I've given you and so on. So, no strings attached. Sometimes you give them that freedom. For that you ask the question. But there are times when you just keep asking them questions and trying to dress it all up and tell them, I went through hell and back to get this for you. Do you know? It was so difficult to get this. I had to ask from this person and then go to that shop and it was not there. And when I went to the other shop, it was late at night and I had to park outside and wait for hours to get it. Just so that I can bring it to you on time. Do you know? Yes, I know. Well, then. Sometimes we are just thirsty for a thank you. That is not without strings attached. That is with strings attached. There may be occasions where you have helped someone to get a job. I'm sure there are plenty of individuals here. You've helped someone, you know, climb up the career ladder, get them to land themselves a job, right? Submit a few applications, help them with their CVs and so on. You know, put in a good word on someone's behalf, as a result of which, you know, they got the job. Typically, what is expected? A phone call. To do what? To thank you, right? So you get to hear that they've got the job. It's been a day now. It's been 2 days. It's been 3 days. It's been payday. But no call. No letter. No card. No nothing. Have you ever caught yourself speaking about this to other people? You know, I helped this man do this. Not even a thank you from him. He didn't even come back and even just, not even a phone call. That's the least I would have expected. That's okay, I'm saying, but that's just not the Bodhisattva Paramita. That's what I'm saying. It's okay. If that's who we are, that's okay. It's just not the Arahatta Buddha Bodhisattva Paramita. You can become someone, but you can't become no one like that. Yeah? You can become someone like that. But if you're trying to become a no one, a nobody, you can't become a nobody like that. That's why charity, number one in the paramita list. People think it's easy to do. Oh boy, then they've got another thing coming. Eight, not easy to do. It's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to do. I mean, you are not like that, but I remember when we first ordained, and sometimes when we go to other places, sometimes we are invited. Those days we used to travel, but now we don't. Those days we used to go for alms givings and things like that. And typically, you know, if someone, because usually they don't stop when they start serving. They don't realize that this is just a stomach. Right? That inside this robe is a human being. Right? And so when they serve, they want their serving to be accepted. So imagine there's like 10 dishes. So the first serving is rice. The second serving is parippu, but the quantity is about the same as the rice. At the end of this queue, with your arms bowed, you begin to wonder, what am I having with what? Because typically you have rice with curries, right? But after this arms round, you begin to wonder, oh, good Lord, is it curry with rice or parippu with sambal, or what am I having today? With you, I don't have that problem. Because you just give me a spoonful. You're stingy, aren't you? Stingy. Stingy Rajagiris. That's all you give me, a spoonful. For all that I give you, all you give me is a spoonful. Next year, I'll give you a spoonful of Dhamma. I'm just jesting. Stick to the spoonful. But we used to have this problem, and I suspect that many Swamin Vahanses, Silmanian Vahanses, they must have this problem, I imagine. Now at the monastery, we have our Anagarika Mahatyas who guide when you come to give Dhane. They guide you, right? They tell you just this much of this, that much of that, and we have specific spoons for that. So we have spoons for good measure. But I have been on the receiving end of some very interesting dana offerings where at the end of the alms round, and I don't mean this with any disrespect by any means, because I understand why they do it, and you know, it's with deep devotion. I admire that truly. I was once like that. But at the end of that alms offering, and at the end of my consuming my meal, I'm left with so much food in my alms bowl. The next problem I have is, how am I going to give this alms bowl back to the devotee? Because I'm certain that one thing is going to happen the moment they come and take it off from my hands. What? You tell me, dear devotees. Typically what they do is they look into the alms bowl and they check. These are the leftovers, right? They check what I have left over. Especially if it's the one that they served. So imagine it's that cake that only you know how to bake. And the there was a slice or a piece of cake that was put into the alms bowl and that remained untouched. So just a small bit of it was eaten, but the rest of it just remained in the alms bowl. 9 times out of 10, that would end up hurting them. It would hurt their feelings. That's why in the monastic tradition, we have a practice. When we have any food left in the alms bowl, we mix it all up. Whatever is left over, we mix it all up. To the point where it becomes indistinguishable. Well, it's not always possible. But we try and do it for who? On whose behalf, do you think? On behalf of the devotee, so that when they take the alms bowl back and they, lest they look at it and they feel hurt, because that's not what we want. We want them to earn merits out of it, right? But they look at it and if they're hurt, in vain, isn't it? So, but I myself personally, I really dislike throwing and wasting food. So there have been occasions, at the monastery now I don't have this problem, but back then when we used to travel, even when it was difficult to eat, I would still consume the whole meal. Why? Because I don't want to hurt their feelings. So I take the pain so that they can just walk away without pain. See what we have to do as monks. Are you going to tell me that that is a dana? Is that a dana? That is not a dana. That's a dhima. Strings attached. So what we should do is, when someone rings up or comes to the monastery and says, I want to offer a dana, we should ask them, with strings attached or without strings attached? Right, so we should have it in two versions. So if it's with strings attached, we must send some swaminarayanas who can take a good meal. Where there are some swaminarayanas who can't eat much. So we no point sending them, because if it comes with strings attached, then we have to be very careful about how much we take into alms bowl, as well as if there's any food left, then we have to make sure that it's either all mixed up so that it's not distinguishable what they have served, or take the whole meal and leave the alms bowl empty. So these are some of those challenges. But the point is not about the challenge. The point is about charity, giving. Giving with strings attached and giving without strings attached. There's a very important distinction between these two things, ladies and gentlemen, and I want you to understand the difference between them. Because one is not a paramita. One is just merit. I don't deny that there's merit. There's plenty of merit in giving with strings attached, but that's pure merit. It will not help you become the bodhisattva, become the arahant that you want to be. For that, giving must be given without strings attached. Easy to do or difficult to do? Very difficult. It's particularly difficult because we have a sense of self. What about me? Is the question that always comes into our minds. What about me? What about mine? What about the one that I cooked? What about the one that I served? I put in a lot of work for that. Aren't I special to you? Is what your mind always screams out loud asking the other person. See, catch them in their wake. Be mindful. This is bhavana. Trust me, this is bhavana. This is meditation. If you can always be aware of the thoughts that go through your mind, you don't always have to sit cross-legged, eyes closed. back straight? No. Not at all. To meditate is to contemplate. Observe your thoughts. Whenever you give something, ask yourself, do I expect something back? Something in return for this giving? Who's that person to whom I expect something to come back? Ah, then there's a me there in that equation. Then you have failed the test. See, when that happens, you have the Dhamma. If we talk about the sense of self, I talked to you and explained to you how this is just a cognitive phantom and all these things, right? So when you catch yourself as it happens, that is the moment to apply the Dhamma. Bring in anicca, bring in dukkha, bring in anatta, and kill the demon. The moment you spot that it's going on in your mind, I'm expecting something in return for my giving, kill the demon. That is when you need anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So what else is it there for then, if you don't use it then? Do you understand what I'm saying? Use it. This is a weapon to use. This is a tool to use. And you must. The more you use it, the sharper it becomes. And the better you get at it. So I'll explain the Dhamma to you again today. In other words, in other examples, using other metaphors and similes and so on. But for what purpose is what matters the most, ladies and gentlemen? Dhamma for the sake of the Dhamma is really pointless. Then you become like Potila Andhra. Potila Andhra lived in the time of the Buddha. He was there in the times of previous Buddhas. We know this because our Buddha said so. But he'd spent so many years learning the Dhamma, but not assimilating the essence of it. He had not applied what he had learned. To become a Sotapanna is the day on which or from which you begin to apply the Dhamma. If you don't apply the Dhamma, then typically that's because you have understood it but not comprehended it. You understand the logic of it, but it has not become part of your system. It's not part of your operating system. But once you become a stream enterer, now that is the stream that you're in. Therefore, every experience that comes your way, you are now able to look through the lens of the Dhamma and examine your thoughts and identify, is there a self here again? Because you know that there is no such thing called a self. This is only the effects of causes, right? That's where that knowledge becomes useful, comes handy. So if there are grudges, the Dhamma won't work with you. You've got to put aside those grudges. At least there cannot be outwardly behaviors. That is very, very important. I really hope that you have come to a point in life where you no longer shout at people, scream at them, tell them off. I mean, you know, if you speak to them politely, that's okay. That's not what I'm talking about. Politely, respectfully. But if someone does something wrong, you've got to explain it to them. But in your mind, you must not have the intention to hurt. That's what I mean. Did I explain to you the other day that it is not our duty to punish, but only to teach? Assume that you are a policeman, a police officer. Let's assume that you're a traffic police officer. Right? If you catch someone speeding, then you would stop them. Right? So this is another analogy. See whether this makes sense to you. So you're a traffic police officer. You see a speeding car. You stop the car. Okay, then pull up. Your job now is to do what? You can do one of two things. Okay? I don't mean what does the constitution say, what does the law say. I mean, in this scenario, think of it, the difference between a punishment and a teaching. You can either punish this individual for having sped. You can punish this individual, the driver of the vehicle, for having sped, gone over the speed limit. What good does that do? I'm not arguing or debating the law here. So please don't put me behind bars. This is not contempt of the law or anything. Right? I'm just asking the question. This is a very logical, reasonable question, I hope. What good is it now to punish an individual who has sped? Can we go back in time and then undo what has already been done and get them to drive back that stretch of road but within the speed limit? Is that achieved when you fine this individual or punish them? Do you think if you fine them or punish them, they're going to leave happy? Is that going to happen? Have you ever been very delighted to receive a fine? Yeah, you got a fine today. All right. But what if your job description was not to fine or punish, but stop them as they're doing their wrongdoing, to prevent what might happen next if they continue to do what they are doing? Just think about that for a second, ladies and gentlemen. Because now they're speeding up along the way, the highway, the motorway, whatever, on the road, on the street, and you stop them, but you stop them anyway, you stop them and say, "Sir." Would they say sir? I don't know. Who says sir in that conversation? That's debatable. But if I made the rules, that's what I would do. So the officer says, "Sir, madam, do you know what I have stopped you for? Do you know what I have stopped you for? Well, I must have violated some road rules. What was I doing? What wrong was I doing? Well, the speed limit on this road is 45, 50 kilometers per hour. You were doing 60. Do you know why it's wrong to be going above the speed limit, sir? Well, yes, but you know, I'm in a rush. I have to get to this place. But do you realize that when you go above the speed limit, chances are you might not actually get to where you want to be? Better late than never, sir. But if you go above the speed limit, you might never get where you want to be. And there are other road users. You might end up harming them, hurting them, causing a lot of damage. Would you please be mindful and not speed on this road and stick to the speed limit? Can you promise me that you would do that? Would you be mindful about your speed? I will. Are you sure? Yes, I will. See, now this is not a punisher. This is a teacher. The driver in the car, he's happy because you've not punished him. Perhaps if he was not mindful about the road conditions and what harm could have happened to him and to others, now you're reminding him of all that and he realizes the gravity of what he was doing. And he's grateful that you have reminded him. With gratitude, he says, "Thank you." And with gratitude, you say, as a police officer, "Thank you." End of the conversation, and they drive along. You don't earn any demerit by doing this. No demerit in this conversation. In fact, you earn merits out of it. Because what you have done is you have prevented harm coming to someone. You have given someone some knowledge. You have reminded them of what bad could have come. And you have given them a reminder of what is good, what is right. So I'm not suggesting that from here on that is how the roads are going to be. I'm just saying this is how I would do it if it was down to me. But maybe that's why I'm not in that job. They wouldn't put me there. See, that's the thing. The world works in one way, but if you want to get to Nibbana, it's a completely the other way. Anya hilabu panisa anya Nibbana gamini. The way the world works, the way the systems have been set up, the way everything works out there, it's not conducive to Nibbana, because they didn't have Nibbana in mind. That was not the purpose when they wrote the constitution. You think they all got together? How can we get our population, people to attend Nibbana? Let's write the constitution. You think that's how they did that? Every time there's a revision, do you think they revisit Nibbana? There was one constitution that was written like that. It is called the Code of Conduct for the Mahasangha. The purpose behind that was Nibbana. So when the Buddha laid down the 227 rules for the Mahasangha, that is also a constitution. And the purpose behind that is Nibbana. So I just want you to take the essence of that story, that's all. I'm not suggesting that if you do become a police officer, by some stroke of luck, a traffic police officer, right, that from there on you follow my instructions, because I'm not the one giving your paycheck at the end of the day, right, that you have to follow whatever rules, systems, regulations are out there, right? Follow the norms. But if I ever hired you, I would not hire you as a punisher. I would hire you as a teacher. In the sasana, we only have teachers. Because we don't need to punish someone. They punish themselves, don't they? If you're angry, do you need to be punished as well on top of that? You're angry at someone, just assume. Are you punished for your anger or are you punished by your anger? Which do you think? You're punished by your anger. So then should you also be punished again on top of that? No, you're already punished. That is the punishment you give yourself. Anger is a punishment that one gives whom? Oneself. So when I speak to you and I say, do try and control that temper, do try and not be angry at other people, I'm not really suggesting that you must do it on other people's behalf, ladies and gentlemen. What I'm saying is, stop punishing yourselves. You're not that bad. You're better than that. You're good people. You don't need to punish yourselves like this. Therefore, take the medicine of the Dhamma and free yourself from this self-inflicted, self-imposed punishments. So all these negative emotions like lust and desire and anger and jealousy and greed and resentment and repentance, all of these are emotions of self-inflicted, self-imposed punishments. Actually, it's in one word, it's kind of like suicide. You're killing yourself. You're killing your happiness. That's what you're doing. You're killing your happiness. So I'm here to try and stop you from committing suicide. That sounds really weird. So, are you the standard that I expect you to be? Can you strive for that? If you're there yet, or if you're getting there yet, that's okay. That's good, right? But that is the standard I expect from you. What is the standard? Someone spits in your face, you always wipe it with your right hand. No? Left hand. So that the next moment they come up to you and request for your help, your assistance, you're always ready to extend your hand and to give them the help and the support they need. So that you don't get their spit back on them. That's the level I expect if you claim to be Dharmishta. Otherwise you're just Rajagirians. Right? If you really truly want to call yourself Dharmishta Rajagirians, then you have to reach that standard. It's not easy, therefore I'm going to give you the Dhamma to help you achieve that. Fair enough? Right, now let's listen to the Dhamma. Because now you know what the Dhamma is for. If I just gave you the discourse, It's just a Dhamma for the sake of Dhamma. What's the point of that? Then you will take down notes, you will remember it, you will memorize it, and then what's the point? You get a Dharmacharya certificate. What's the point? I'm not here to make philosophers out of you. I'm here to make good human beings out of you. I don't want philosophers. People who can truly love the world. Truly, altruistic love. That is what I want from each and every one of you. Love everyone just as you love your own child. Your only child. Not your own child, but your only child. Love everyone as you love your only child. Not easy. I know it's not easy. It never was. It never was supposed to be easy. But that's only because there's a demon inside you. Now I'm going to give you a potion to kill the demon. Right. Let's do it then. Right. Now to understand this, you need to pay attention. So I need your full attention. Freshen yourselves up if you need to. Sit upright, straight. Up. Because this is going to need a good level, a good degree of attention, focus, and don't be distracted. Try not to be distracted. And try and understand the essence of what I'm trying to share with you. Because this is what's going to help you become what I explained to you earlier. Okay? Right. What is this? A mug, a cup, whatever. This is a mug? Mug. This is a mug. Why do you call it a mug? Why do you call it a mug? Why do you call it a mug? Sorry? What's that? Because? Okay. It can contain liquids. You could use it to drink water. Eh? In fact, I use this back at the monastery. This is what I drink my hot water from. I have a flask. This is what I drink my hot water from. So, I want this back. Don't take it. This is a mug. Yeah? Okay. Are you sure this is a mug? You are, right? Otherwise you wouldn't have said it, that it was a mug. Okay. It's a what? It's a mug. But you just said it was a mug. And now it's a pencil holder or a pen holder. So previously it was a mug. Now it's a pen holder. Okay. Sure, right? It's a pen holder, not a mug. Another purpose. Right? What's this? A pen holder? Huh? A drum? Oh, I thought it was a pen holder. Sorry. I must have misheard you before. So it's a drum. You seem to keep changing your mind all the time. Then it became a pen holder, okay. Then it became a drum. Some people are going, "Ayyo." All that effort we put into come on, please make your mind up. What is this, man? What is this? So if you started with a mug. So why did you stop calling it a mug and then call it a pen holder? Okay, so now there are newcomers here. They're wondering, okay, where is this going? Then there are regulars here who are throwing out answers, right? Because you know, like, okay, I get it, Swami, no answer. Right. Now what I want you all to do is to answer, but silently. Answer each of my questions, right? Don't not answer them. Answer them, but silently. Why silently? Because I don't want you to give the answer scheme, marking scheme to everyone in the room. Because they must also do the test on their own. Because this is one of the best ways to understand something, when the answer comes from within. When you hear the answer from someone else, you remember it. But if you can get it to come in from within yourself, it becomes your conviction, not just a mere belief. Okay? So now think about what we just did there. When I casually held this thing up to you, I didn't even have to put the water in it. Immediately you call this a mug. Why did you call this a mug and not, I don't know, a pen? It's because you identified characteristics. You identified a bunch of characteristics that qualifies this object that I hold in my hand to be called a mug. What are some of those characteristics? Now you can answer, because that everyone's going to know. You can put some substance into this without it all leaking from the other side, right? So it can hold some substance. Therefore, it's one of the characteristics checked. Then it also has a handle. Typically, it's good, usually very convenient to have a handle. So usually when you have a handle of that shape attached to the container, so you know, without that, it still looks like a mug, but you might just call it a container. But when you put that thing on, now it becomes a, this is more characteristic of a mug. And the size is about right, isn't it? What if this was like a meter long? You typically wouldn't expect that from a mug, would you? So this is about the right size. So size-wise, again, is characteristically, it is in the mug space. So this is very much mug material, isn't it? And then I, of course, demonstrated putting some water into it and drinking it. All of that then fits the bill. Therefore, you take it for granted. I choose my words very carefully, and I want you to pay attention to each word that I use here now. You take it for granted that this is a mug. I ask you a question. If I poured water into this and it leaked from the bottom, would you still call this a mug? Would you? No. You might say it's a broken mug or a punctured mug, a damaged mug. But you wouldn't just call it a mug. And then if I sort of turned it like this and I showed you that there were lots of little holes, like a sieve. What do you call this with the India thing? What is it called? Strainer. Strainer? String hopper mold. Mold? Where you put the pity and then, okay, the string hopper mold. So if you saw lots of little holes in it, you might think, okay, so what Swaminarayan has done is he's brought one of the string hopper molds and put water into it, and now of course it's going to leak. No wonder, that's not a mug. That's what you use to make string hoppers. But this you take for granted as a mug. And when you take this for granted as a mug, ladies and gentlemen, what happens is there are a whole bunch of characteristics you also take for granted, and you expect those characteristics to be present in and about this object. That's why you readily put water into this and expect for this container to hold it. And you expect to hold it by this handle, and when you pull on it, the mug to come with it, don't you? Just imagine if you pull that and you just like elastic and this just stayed put. What would that do if that happened? It would disrupt your sense of realism, wouldn't it? It would like, whoa, what's going on here? I'm pulling on it and it won't come. It would feel very weird if that were to happen. Just think about why that is. Why you would feel that was very weird, very unsettling. If you poured water into this and all that water leaked from the bottom, why would you find that very unsettling? Isn't that because, right? Isn't that because you take this as a mug, you take it for granted that this is a mug, and therefore there are a bunch of characteristics which you also take for granted because all those characteristics are characteristically mug. They're characteristic of a mug. So to put it very simply, I hold in my hand a mug. And the mug has X, Y, Z, these characteristics. That is the way your brain processes this. Not your brain, but rather your mind. And there's a flaw with that. We moved on to the pen holder. So as I grab these pens and put into this, now you stop calling it a mug. I asked you, what is it now? And you said that was a pen holder. See how quickly you jumped from a mug to the pen holder? When I used this as a pen holder, did I take away from this the characteristics of a mug? Did I? So could it not be used as a mug again? In fact, if I had the pens in here, could I also not still put water into it? I could, right? But imagine this for a second. Just imagine that this object had been manufactured at the factory for the precise purpose of doing this. Just as this has been manufactured. You wouldn't then call this a mug, would you? Right now you see something wrong here. Even worse if I had put water into this. Why so? Because you'll tell me, Swaminarayan, you just got it all wrong. You put the wrong stuff into the wrong thing. This would be one of those questions you can expect to find in your scholarship exams. Right? Spot the odd one out. It'll be me. Because you've got the pens in the mug and the water in the pen holder. You'll say, that's just wrong. Think about why you think that's wrong. There's a reason for this. At the end, you will realize how all of this is relevant and related to what we discussed just a few moments ago. How this knowledge is going to help you do what? That. How this knowledge, we're just talking about a mug and a pen holder, and some water and some pens, right? So right now it might seem very remote, these two things, but we are gradually filling in the gaps. You and I, we are working together to fill in the gaps. Eventually, you will see how this knowledge is what's going to help you wipe the spit off your face with the left hand and extend your right hand with grace. With grace. Not with patience, with grace. But right now, these two things seem unconnected. But we'll see. Let's work out the connection between these two. The Dhamma is here for a purpose. Not Dhamma for the sake of the Dhamma. Yeah? That would be simply a waste of time. Trust me. Right then. Why do you now call this a pen holder? Because it has the characteristics of holding pens. In fact, if I put these pens in like this and they dropped out the bottom the moment I put them in, would you still call this a pen holder? No. Just the same as if I put the water and the water just leaked out, you wouldn't call it a mug. If I put the pens in and they just immediately dropped out the other end, you wouldn't call this a pen holder. So you call it a pen holder because it holds pens. So what qualifies this object to be called a pen holder? The magic word is the characteristics. Take away the characteristic of holding water or any liquid from this object. Take away that characteristic. Now, this is something you're going to have to do with. This is an abstract concept I'm talking to you about, okay? If you were able to take away the characteristic of containing water or liquid, would you still call this a mug? Would you? No. If you took away the characteristic of holding pens, would this ever qualify to be called a pen holder? No. Therefore, would you agree with me then, ladies and gentlemen, that these objects only qualify, are only entitled to these names because they exhibit a bunch of characteristics? See, you were very quick to call this a vase. You call this a vase because the moment I put these flowers in, they rested very comfortably. But if I put the flowers in, it came out the other end. Or if I put the flowers in and they dissolved in it or something, then you wouldn't call it that. Then the qualification that this object, this mug or this object. So here's the distinction. The qualification that this object has to be called a vase is it has the characteristic of holding these flowers in place the moment you place it there. That is a characteristic. Now I have a very subtle but very interesting question. Is this a characteristic of a vase, or is the presence of that characteristic that qualifies this object to be called a vase? The first or the second? The second, indeed. Right now it might seem that they're both the same. To some of you, at least it might seem. Swami Nivas is saying if A equals B, is A equal to B or B equal to A? Isn't that the same thing? It's not the same thing. I don't mean the same thing when I ask these two questions. Once again. What just happened there? What just happened there? Another was. In fact, you know, if you saw this like this the first day, for the first time you saw it, right, there's one thing you would never have called this. What's that? A pen holder. You would never have called it a pen holder. You'd always have called it a vase. Don't you agree with me? Of course you do. But the first time you saw this, this had pens in it. Do you see how that sight, that perception immediately registered in your mind that this is a pen holder. And henceforth, from that day on, whether it liked it or not, this always had to be a pen holder, but from time to time used for other things, such as now. Swami Nuhan say, by mistake, drop the flowers into the pen holder. In fact, you know what you would say when you look at this now? You say, he's using the pen holder as a vase. Gentlemen, aren't you using someone's daughter as a wife? Why do you look down in embarrassment? Huh? Come on, look up. Look at me when I ask you a question. See? What am I doing right now? I'm using a pen holder, complete the sentence, as a vase. What did I do earlier with this? I used a mug as a pen holder. And then I used the mug as a drum. And then I used the mug as a vase. So this was always a mug, wasn't it? So this was always a mug, only I used it in different ways. That's what your mind tells you. It means you have fixed this as a mug. This is now done. It's a mug. I mean, there's no hope now. If this ever had any ambition of becoming anything more than a mug, it might as well forget it. Because not under your watch can this ever become or grow on to become anything more than a mug. Paune? See, you just won't let it become anything more than a mug. I'm trying my best to give it more value, give it more recognition. See how good I am. I'm trying to put this here and say, look at this vase. Isn't it beautiful? And you're going, no, Swami, no answer. That's just a mug being used as a vase. Discrimination. You discriminate. Why don't you give it a fighting chance? Why don't you just let this thing become whatever it wants to be? And then when people discriminate you, that's not okay. Right? You will fight until the end, until you are free from discrimination. But this poor cup, this poor mug, as you call it, in my world, this is just an object. It has infinite potential. This has infinite potential. It has potential to be a pen holder. It has potential to be a drum. It has potential to be a vase. But you won't let it. Because no matter how much I try, you'll always keep calling it a mug. Because you have sealed its fate. You have sealed its fate. That's why you can't forgive your past. That's why you can't forget and move on from your past. That's why you keep cursing yourselves for yesterday's mistakes. The same reason you can't not discriminate this. See? It's no small thing. It's no easy matter, ladies and gentlemen. I'm using a simple mug to explain to you what you are doing to yourselves. That's why yesterday's mistakes haunt you today. Because once it was done, then you discriminate yourself as the one who did it. Think whether you don't. And the same you do to others as well. You call them your loved ones. How much do you really love them? If you just won't let them move on, One day he was a mug, all right. Yeah, yeah. You mug. One day he did something very muggish, right? But today he wants to move on. He wants to be a vase and carry you the flower. And let you rise and be pretty. But you just won't let it. Because in your mind, you have permanently discriminated him, her, them, us, and yourself. See, something simple to explain something very profound. Or would you rather me take the Tripitaka and give you a discourse on that? This is for me, Dhamma, applied to real life. You see what's going on here, right? I'm trying to give this a new lease of life. Right? This is more than a mug to me. I think this can become more than that. Just assume, imagine, as a mug, it would fetch 500 rupees in the marketplace. But as a pen holder, this would fetch 1,000 rupees in the marketplace. Right? So if I could qualify this to be a pen holder, this would become more valuable, wouldn't it? That's what I'm trying to do. See, I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to give it more value. And now I'm going to call it a pen holder, but you wouldn't let it. Because you can't let this move on from its past. Because you discriminate this. Because you say, no, Swami. And so as much as it tries, this is not a pen holder. You can't fool us. This is just a mug trying to pretend to be a pen holder. So I can't give 1,000, I'll only give 500. In fact, I'll cut another 100 just for trying to pretend to be something else that it is not. See? That's what you do. It's what you do to your children. It's what you do to your spouses. It's what you do to your friends. It's what you do to your colleagues. And worst of all, complete the sentence. It's what you do to yourselves. Once a womanizer, always a womanizer, right? Once a thief, always a thief, right? Fathers of daughters, I have a question. Fathers of daughters, put your hand up, fathers of daughters. Good. A couple of years ago, a man was incarcerated, put in prison, for an offense, a minor offense, involving a young girl. Minor. Minor offense. A couple of years ago. But yesterday he was released. And while he was in prison, he was rehabilitated, right? He was taught what was right and wrong. And he's come back saying that he would never do something like that again. He makes his promise and it seems like he's okay now. He sees your daughter and he wants her hand in marriage. If you ignore the past, his past, in every other way, he's a good match. The horoscopes match first things first, right? Okay. Horoscopes match. Comes from a good family, notwithstanding what happened. Comes from a good family. Has enough to look after your girl. He has enough to feed her and give her a good future and all that. But of course, for full disclosure, I have to let you know that a couple of years ago, he was in prison for an offense which involved a girl. So it was some stranger, he bumped into her and then did something, but not like serious crime, but for that he was sent for 2 years prison. But now he's out of prison. Right? So now the law has determined that he's no harm to society. That's why he's been released. So, fathers of daughters, dear fathers of daughters, this young man wishes to marry your daughter. Are you ready for the next question? So you are Dharmishtha Rajagirians, right? You don't discriminate, right? You apply the Dhamma, right? This young man wishes to marry your daughter. If everything else is a match, would you give your unreserved consent? Why is the room all so silent all of a sudden? Why is this pin drop silence all of a sudden? Why? Because you discriminate. Because of his past. And you go to the stock market, you say, past performance is what? Is not an indication of future performance of this stock. So please invest cautiously. But when it comes to this man, who in his past 2 years ago, two long years ago, committed a minor offense. I mean, there are plenty of others who commit these offenses, only some get caught, others don't. Just because you commit an offense doesn't mean you end up in prison, right? You have to get caught for that. And then you have to be tried at court. And then you have to be sentenced. There are plenty of people who don't get caught, and therefore they're out in the open. Maybe you're actually trying to get your daughter married to someone like that. They might have committed even more grievous offenses, but they were just never caught by the law enforcement. But this man, when he was tried in court, he confessed. And he said, yes, I did it. I don't know what got over me, but I did it anyway. And I'm really sorry. I regret what I did. But, you know, if I'm due to be punished, then I will serve my sentence. And then so he was sent 2 years in prison. Now he's back. But you won't give your daughter's hand in marriage to this man. Why? For the same reason you say that this mug is pretending to be a pen holder. This is why you can't forgive yourself either. This is a symptom of jati. If the answer to my previous question, can you give your daughter's hand in marriage, is no, then that is evidence to you that jati is working inside of you. Simple. Someone borrows some money from you. They don't return it. They promised to return it in 3 weeks. It's been 3 months now. Not been returned. But one fine day, a year later, they come back and say, hey, you know what? I took your money. I promised you I would bring it back in 3 weeks. I know it was 3 months in. I know you gave me a call, but I said I would. I gave you a promise again. I still broke your promise. You called me in 6 months. I promised you that I would, but I didn't keep to my promise. You called me in 9 months. I promised you, and I still didn't keep to my promise. It's a year today, and here, I'm going to return half of the money that I borrowed. Here's half of the money. Right? So they return half of the money, not 3 weeks after they borrowed it, which was the original promise, but a whole year after they promised, but only half again. Okay? So they give you half the money. You take half the money. Better half than nothing. And then another week later, they come back at you and say, excuse me, can I borrow a little bit more? May I borrow just a little bit more? I need something just to, you know, carry me across for another 3 weeks, not more than that, just 3 weeks. I'll promise you, I'll return the money to you. Would you? That's the question, would you? And they say, with that money, I will also return the half of the original borrowing. I will return that and this money altogether. You know, here's one thing that you will think. The moment this man comes to borrow this money, okay, so last week he returned half my money because he was going to come and ask for more this week. So you work all that math in your head. So you think he was just trying to impress you, just trying to make it look like he is a nice guy so that you would, when he comes and asks you again, actually go out and give him some money. So you don't think that was genuine, right? It was not genuine, it was just an act. See, all these things you cook up in your own mind. Do you ask that individual? So last week when you returned that money, that was just an act, wasn't it? You don't ask that. You assume that. But 9.999 times out of 10, ladies and gentlemen, you being the exception, of course, would you lend that money to that person? No. But now he wants to be better. He wants to become the better man. He understands that he was wrong to have done that. And he promises you, I promise you, I will come every week. I will give you a call and I will remind you when I'm going to give you the money. And I will not run away. I will not miss your calls. I'll be very obedient. I'll be very diligent with my dues and all that. But you just can't make your mind up now to give that money again. Why? Discrimination. I'm not suggesting that you mustn't learn lessons from the past, but then to use that lesson and then discriminate an individual or an object or a situation and say that they are permanently like that, that is what we call labeling or passing judgment. If it is your instinct to pass judgment, to give those labels and to say that this is so and this is such, that is because of jati. And just as you pass judgment to others, ladies and gentlemen, you also pass judgment to yourselves. That's why, to be forgiven, you must learn to forgive. One who can't forgive can never forgive oneself. Because the ability to forgive does not discriminate the individual. Whether it is someone else or oneself, it matters not. In the art of forgiving, it matters not who, whether it is someone else or yourself. Whether it is first person or second person or third person, it doesn't matter. We are talking about the ability, the virtue of forgiveness. That applies across the board. You either have it or you don't. Think about this. Think long and hard about the way you behave, your conduct. It's not about who you are right now with me. It's about who you are when I'm not there. When your teacher's not there. When you're not in this community. That's what really matters. Because whether you're here or you're there, you're still adding stuff into your karmic strands. I'll take another example then. What's this? This is a ruler. This is a ruler, right? Yeah? Sure? Why are you all so silent? When I ask you a question, you can speak up. And if you have to give silent answers, I'll let you know. What is this? A what? What again? And now it became a back scratcher. But I thought this was a ruler. Why did you just call it a back scratcher? Because Swami Nuanse used the ruler as a back scratcher, right? I see. So you're never going to let this become a back scratcher, are you? This will always be a ruler. This will forever and always be a ruler, but can also be used as a back scratcher. And you are Dharmishta. If I used your past against you, you would never call yourselves Dharmishta. Fortunately, I let you go. I don't hold your past against you. See, when it comes to you, you have different standards. But when it comes to this, you discriminate. Now this is a ruler trying to be used as a back scratcher. Why won't you let this become a back scratcher? Think. Really, seriously think about this, ladies and gentlemen. This is because of jati. This is the reason you can't do this and this. This is the reason. You judge. You cast this in stone. You hold grudges. Although you said, no, we don't hold grudges. We are virtuous. Of course you hold grudges. It's not you who holds the grudge. It's jati that does that. That's why freedom from jati is true freedom. Freedom from anything else, but you still have jati, there is no freedom at all. What's this then? What's this? A what? A fan. I thought you said it was a book. It's a fan, is it? You have a book used as a fan. So this can never become a fan then, can it? See, as a book, it fetches very little value. But assume that we could make a fan out of... not make a fan out of it. The king wants a fan. Right? The king of the land wants a fan, and he's happy to pay for this in gold. So he says, can I have a fan, please? And you say, no, I only have a book. But for a fan, he's prepared to give you a lot of money, a lot of gold, but not for a book. Because he doesn't read or write. You're going to deprive this object its right, its privilege to become a fan, right? Because this is a book. If I put my name on it and put it like this, now what is it? It's a name tent. Now, you can have in conferences and so on. What are they called? Name tents. Name? Name holder. Name holder. So, what is it then? Is it a name holder? Is it a fan? Is it a book? It's a book used as a fan or a book used as a name holder. That's what it is, right? If this had been manufactured to do this, you would have called this a fan. And then if I had opened it up like this and started writing things on it, then you would say, Swami Nuhas is using a fan as a book. Therefore, you have already labeled everything in this world. To you, sanya is not mere sanya. The Buddha says that sanya is like a mirage. treat sanya as a mirage. That is a metaphor that he gives, or the simile that he gives. Sanya is merely a mirage. It is not the presence of water. It is merely the perception of it. It's not the presence of water, just the perception of water. But when we give things names, we actually tell ourselves that that is that very object and we entify it. This happens because of jati. That's why in our world we have objects and they are fixed in their ways. These are objects, we have given it a name, we have given it a specific purpose, that we have actually specified things. That's what we've done. We've specified. This is specified as a book. This is specified as a ruler. And this is a specified mug. It's very specific. Now if you use it for any other purpose, you say, this is the specified object used for something else. And that is why when someone spits on your face, it's difficult to wipe it with your left hand and extend your right. It's difficult because when this individual comes to shake hands with you now, you have already labeled this person as the person who spat on your face. This is that person, is what you think. This is that person. And that is this person. Meaning, you connect things in time. So your world is now temporal. Not akaliko. Kaliko. Things in this world are connected through the dimension of time. Therefore, everything has a past. And therefore, everything will have a future. So if what's now is just the present, but temporal present. Therefore, everything has a time. Everything is bound by time. Therefore, your past is your past. Your future is your future. Your present is your present. Therefore, you become an individual who exists. You don't really, but that is how you perceive yourself. You perceive yourselves as sentient beings that exist. And the moment you think that you exist, you have then find a dimension in which to exist. And the word for that is samsara. Samsara is your dimension of existence. That's why you're still in samsara. But buduhandru apiddakinnati, banattahannati. Habai nivandakindu pingmadivennati, ekaitavman samsara. You're still in samsara because you discriminate. You're still in samsara because you call this a pen holder or a mug used as a pen holder. What is the truth then? If that is the falsehood, if that is the lie, if that is the non-truth, then what is the truth? Let's look at the truth. Good as new, huh? What is the truth? Let's see if we can wrap our heads around the truth. Ready? Okay. Do you understand the problem now? And do you understand why it matters? Why the problem matters to you? This is not a scholarly task. Right? This is not just to make scholars out of you. Right? This is Dhamma for life. You have a problem. You can't forgive yourselves. You can't let go of your past. And you can't let others move on either. You keep punishing people from yesterday's mistakes. Someone cheats on you, when do you smile back at them? Again. If you found out that your spouse or your lover, your loved one has cheated on you, when do you smile at them again? After how many years? Sometimes maybe, never again. Why? Can't move on. They have moved on. That's the thing. They've moved on. They've listened to the Dhamma. They've realized, that was my mistake. I realized I succumbed to my desires. And now I realize that was wrong and I'm never going to do that again. But you can't. That's why all these relationships are so fragile. Honestly, your relationships are very fragile, ladies and gentlemen. As much as you like to think that we have a very strong link, very strong bond, right, whether that is between your husbands and wives, or children and parents, or siblings, best friends, right, you think your relationships are so strong. Really? How can they be? How could they be? When in any relationship, if any relationship is self-centered, that relationship cannot be a strong relationship because it rusts every day. It's like a chain that has begun to rust. It is very fragile. The moment yourself is hurt, right? That is the day that that chain, that bond starts to break. And once a few cracks start to appear, soon enough, those cracks will lead on to become bigger cracks, and then one day the chains will be destroyed. They're very brittle. That's why relationships don't last very long. And even once you formalize those relationships, and you know, like when you have legal relationships, husband, wife, that's a legal relationship. Typically what happens is, sometimes people are together because they have already signed the paperwork. In some occasions it's like that. But the spark is gone, the affection is gone, the relationship is gone, the true relationship is now gone. It's no longer there. But you're there with that person, either because of the children, or because there's a document that says that the two of you have to remain married, husband and wife. This is because relationships are self-centered. If you want a pure relationship with someone, pure relationship, a pristine relationship is based on non-self. That's why some of the best relationships are between two arahants. These are the world's best relationships. The world's purest relationships, sublime, noble, between an arahant and another. How self-centered is this relationship? What is the degree of self-centeredness in this relationship? As a percentage?
Zero.
Are they ever hurt because of them? Are they ever hurt because of them? No. So if you really want a strong, good, noble relationship, your effort has to be to try and work on yourself. I often hear people saying, when they're friends or colleagues, I'm going to work hard for you. And the other guy says, yeah, good, I'm going to work hard for you. I think there's something better that you can do than that. Work hard on yourself for the other person. Improve yourself. If you're the husband here, she's the wife. Improve yourself for her. Improve yourself for him. Don't try to improve him. Or don't try to improve her. That's what people typically tend to do. Those are all self-centered motives. Self-centered. Therefore, it always hurts. Usually there's a lot of friction, conflict, But if you can try and work on yourself, and this individual works on themselves, now you're both working on yourselves. When you start working on yourself, ladies and gentlemen, this relationship, what you're really doing is removing the rust, de-rusting that connection, that link. And you end up with a really strong, noble relationship. How much trust do you think there is between these two individuals? If they're both arahants. Degree of trust. As a percentage? 100%. How much trust do you have in your relationship? Don't answer that. But you know that the truth is not this. You know that the truth is, it is not 100%. I can't blame you for that. I can't fault you for that. There cannot be a wife who is actually a wife who 100% trusts her husband. Then you're not a wife. Then you're an arahant. And there cannot be a husband in this room or any other room for that matter who trusts his wife 100%. There cannot be. Because if there was, then that is not a husband. He's an arahant. So what course do you think you should take if you want a good relationship between husband and wife? What seminars do you think you ought to go to? Family counseling? Which books do you think you ought to read? Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. Or would you rather listen to a sermon? The Buddha's philosophy. Because the Buddha's philosophy doesn't talk about how you can work on this individual or how this individual can work on this individual. He talks about how you do you become free from yourself. And how does this individual become free from themselves? So if you are both in the Dhamma, then this link does not start rusting from either end. And you end with a very pure, noble relationship where you have 100% trust. I encourage heads or leaders, decision makers of companies, departments, teams, if you want to trust your employees, if that is something your organization values, trust between your employees, your colleagues. I mean, you can send them on seminars and talks and you can try and give them incentives and all that. You can take them on field trips and do all sorts of, you know, team building exercises, activities, all that sort of stuff. Try. But the moment the self is hurt, then all that logic, rhyme and reason goes out the window. The true mark of trust, the true source of trust comes from selflessness. So if you want that in your organizations, be that your family as the organization that matters to you the most, or your company, or your office, your town, your neighborhood, your whatever, try and give them a little bit of Dhamma. At least a little bit of Dhamma. This is where organizational trust begins. Right. That was not what I was going to talk to you about. Here's what I was going to talk to you about. Why does this happen then? Why do we discriminate like this? Why do we feel that this is a mug trying to be a pen holder? It's because of this. What is this? Let's go back to the beginning. A mug. This is a mug. This is as important as this. You might think this is just an article, a bit of grammar. No, there's a reason why we call it a monk. We use these articles to identify objects distinctively. Either a mug or the mug. That's the definite article. This is the indefinite article. A mug. But when you call this a mug, here's something else you say when you call it a mug. It's nothing else. Think about it. See, all these years we learned grammar, didn't we? But never did we stop to think about it through the lens of Dhamma. Of course, we never had the Dhamma. When you call it a mug, right? When you think of this as a mug, what else comes with the package? That this is not anything else. What is this? So complete the sentence for me, okay? Hold on. Isn't this what it is? When you say this is a mug, it's not just that you say, right? This is a mug and nothing else. Only we hide this part. We don't say this out loud, do we? But is that not part of this expression, a mug? This is a mug and nothing else. What about this? Sorry, go on. What is this? A pen and nothing else. Don't take this lightly. It's very, very important, this part. And nothing else. This one? It's a duster. Is it just a duster? Is this just a duster? No, it's a duster and nothing else. But we don't use this, we don't say this every time because it's hidden. Because it would be a mouthful every time you had to say that. She's a girl and nothing else. No, that's the sun and nothing else. That's the moon and nothing else. She's my daughter and nothing else. So if you had to say this every time you spoke of something, right, then there would be these are nouns. Anytime you identify a noun, an object, using a noun, you're also suggesting that it is not any other noun. Do you agree with me on that, folks? Excellent. Do you understand so far what I've tried to get across to you? That when you call something by a name, you're also suggesting that it is nothing else. Okay, that's pretty dangerous that we do that. Although it seems so harmless that we call something this and nothing else, it's actually a very dangerous thing to do. Because here's what happens. When you say that something's a mug and it's nothing else, you are only willing to accept characteristics of a mug. You're only willing and ready and prepared to observe characteristics of a mug and nothing else. Are you with me? I need your attention here and your merits. So let's try it with this. Let's take one characteristic of this object. Can drink water. Can drink water. Assume that is the only characteristic that this has. Right. So then tell me. Tell me what you know about this object. We can use it to drink water and nothing else. We can use it to write and nothing else. What is the danger with that? Well, here's the danger. A mug is identified by characteristics. It's wrong to say its characteristics, because the collection and aggregation of characteristics is actually what we identify. It's not that a mug can be used to drink water. It is merely that when you use an object to drink water out of, you call that object a mug. So it is the characteristics that earned this object the name. And it's not the name that earned the characteristics. Sorry? Make sense? It's the characteristics that earned this object the name, a mug. Okay? Not the other way around. Which do you think came first? The characteristic or the name? Are you sure? Think and answer. I'll give you enough time. If you need, I'll give you more time. You can answer next Sunday if you want. Which came first? The ability to drink water with or the mug? Which came first? The ability to drink water with. The characteristic came first. And then we came to a convention. Conventionally, we came to a consensus. We said, hey, why don't we all just give it a name and not just have to keep calling it that which with which you can drink water. That with which you can drink water. That with which you can drink water. That was too laborious. So what we did, we decided on a name for it. So which came first? Characteristic. Always. The characteristic comes first. Meaning, that's all there is. It's not just the fact that it came first. What's more interesting is, that's all there is. Then why did we come up with the name? That's just for convenience. That's all. So when we saw a bunch of characteristics, we started giving things, not things, we started giving collections of characteristics names. See, this can also be used to drink water, can't it? But you don't call this a mug. Typically you would call this a bowl. Why do you call this a bowl and this one not one? What's missing here? The handle's missing. And the shape, yeah, this is typically the shape of a bowl, right? So how do you identify a bowl and the mug? What is it that helps you identify these two distinctively? Characteristics, indeed. So if I move this, if I swap these places around, now do you still call this the bowl? Because this was on this side and that was on that side? And does this become the mug now? No. Why is that? Is there a specific place for a bowl and a specific place for a mug? No. What's there then? Characteristics. When I move these around, what am I moving? Characteristics. That's what I'm moving around. So if someone in the audience wanted to drink some water, what would they need? Someone in the audience wanted to drink some water. Right? What would they need? Something to hold water, right? So then I would probably have to pass this round. What am I passing around the room then? Characteristics. So just assume this, right? Let's say the gentleman right at the back of the room wanted to drink some water. Okay? I have a bunch of objects with me and I'll pass all of them. At which point does he stop? So you'll keep passing them until he gets to the person at the back, right? And so at which point does he say thank you? When I pass this, this, then this. Why? Indeed. That's not because this is a mug. That's just a name we've given to the characteristic of holding water and the ability from which to drink water. So the moment that this characteristic appears in their presence, now they are content and they are happy that that characteristic can now be put to use. Is it not possible that they might not even know the name of this object? Of course. When we grew up, we never knew the names of the things that we used. For many years, we used things not knowing what they were called. So the name is just a very secondary attribute. What we learn about things are its characteristics. Later on, we come up with names for them. And when we learn a language, what do? Another language. We learn yet more names for the same characteristics. But what's the problem here then? This is just characteristics. Now the really interesting thing about characteristics, ladies and gentlemen, is characteristics are manifested by aggregation of energy. And here's the really juicy part. That was so juicy. The truth is that this is not really a mug. This is just energy. This is energy. You are. The sun is. The moon is. Energy. This is energy. That's why if you set this on fire, this will burn till the end. How? Consuming energy. One form of energy will be converted to another form of energy, into light and heat. That's why once you light this with a candle or a matchstick, you don't have to keep the matchstick held close to it. Now this energy will start converting to light and heat. That means what? This is energy. What about the food that you ate this morning? What was that? Energy. What are you then? Energy. So if you're really hungry and you've got nothing to eat, what could you also potentially do? I mean, if you needed some energy, right, and there was no food available, what could you potentially also do? Huh? You could eat yourself. Because, what are you? Energy. But why is it pointless to do that? Because what are you consuming that energy for? To contain this energy in physical form, right? So there's no point in converting that physical energy to chemical energy and then back to physical energy, because some of that energy will be lost in the process. So if you kept on eating yourself, eventually you'll just become heat and dissipate into the universe. So that's pointless to do. That's why we eat food. And even when we eat food, what do we do to some part of it? The residue of it, we discard it as feces. That is indigestible food, but it's digestible to some other species. There will be some other living creatures that would eat that, and that would be their food because they can still consume energy from that substance. But our digestive systems are not capable of taking energy from that residue. That's just the way we are. So do you see then everything here is energy? The roof above your head is what? Energy. The floor beneath your feet? That's still energy. So the whole universe is then what, ladies and gentlemen? Just energy. Right? Then, If this is just energy, is it not energy in a particular form that exhibits characteristics? Now, I'm asking this question very slowly, and I'm spelling word by word out because I really want you to pay attention and try and get the essence of what I'm trying to capture here. Okay? Is it a mug or is it just energy? What is this? Energy. We agreed that this has a bunch of characteristics, didn't we? One of that characteristics is the ability to hold water. Any liquid, but I just say water, simplicity. Is that a characteristic of a mug? Or is that a characteristic of energy that has taken this composition? First or the second? It's the second. See, here's the thing. When energy aggregates, it does it in many different ways. Fundamentally, the process is the same, but the forms it takes will be very diverse, numerous, and various. See, this is one form of energy. Here's another form of energy. Here's another form of energy. That's why these are called forms. See, that's why they're called forms. I never thought about that. Thank you. It's a form of energy. It's a form. It's one structure. So we say, you know, this is in one form. Here's another form. Typically, when we say it's one form, it also implies that it can also take other forms, right? Yeah. That's why we say this is rupa, meaning form. This is form. Which form? There are two forms. This is one form. This is another form. Which form? Whichever this form. Not this one. This is one form of energy. One structure. One arrangement. Arrangement. This is one arrangement of energy. What is this? Another arrangement of energy. Can we not take this energy, change its form, and get this out of it? Potentially? Yes, we can. I mean, the process might be very laborious, the process might be very energy consuming, it might be very complicated, but it's still possible because if this is energy, this is also energy, then one form of energy could be always converted to another form of energy. So then, what is this? What is the difference between these two things? The different form, yes. That is what is different between these two things. Just the form. Constitutionally, the same. They're both energy. Only different forms. Then, tell me, is it not this formation of energy that now exhibits the characteristic of holding water? Is it not this particular formation of energy that exhibits the containment of water? Is it not this formation of energy that exhibits the characteristic of being able to write? Isn't that a characteristic of this particular formation of energy? Or is that a characteristic of the pen? Which one is it? Energy, ladies and gentlemen, energy. So what we begin to see then is, when energy takes different forms, what happens? They exhibit different characteristics. That's it. Give yourselves a pat on the back. That's what happens. When energy takes different forms, they exhibit different characteristics. You have a very, very common example is H2O. H2O is to be seen as a gas, as liquid, and as solid. Do all three states have the same characteristics? Of course not. It would be absurd to suggest that. How come they exhibit different characteristics? It's just energy. That is still energy, but different forms. So when you have energy more condensed, now we have solid form. When you have less condensed, you have liquid form. When you have even less condensed and more spacious, then we have gas form. But ultimately, is it not just the same hydrogen and oxygen atoms form molecules, those water molecules? There you go. But the same energy, different forms, different arrangements. And arrangements could be in distance between them. It could be in a molecular angle. It could be in a whole lot of things. Let's not get into that just yet. You don't have to worry about that. But essentially, it's just the same energy, but just taking different forms. And what happens when energy takes different forms? They exhibit different characteristics. That's what happens. See, look at all the different characteristics that the food that you cooked at home has taken on today. What am I suggesting you take a look at? Look at yourselves. See, you have hair on your head. Well, most of you have. Isn't that energy that you took when you had your meal? Assume 3 days ago. And then you have nails. Isn't that energy that you took from your meal? There's skin. Isn't that energy that you took from your meal? You have muscle. You have bone. You have nerves. You have blood. You have various other tissues. Isn't all of it, or aren't all of them, energy that you consumed from a meal that you took a few days ago? How come they now demonstrate so many different varieties of characteristic? How are they so different? Different forms, ladies and gentlemen, different forms. You eat the same stuff. When you serve it to your plate, it is just one or two or three different forms. But once it's inside of you, your digestive systems now changes it into a myriad of different forms. That's why these digestion machine, these systems are very sophisticated. Your biology is very sophisticated. So sophisticated that it can take some basic forms. Carbons, hydrogens, oxygens, nitrogens. Carbohydrates, proteins, vitamins, minerals. Just a few bunch of things. And convert it and transform it to a multitude, numerous forms. And they end up as hair, as nails, as skin, as blood, as bones, as nerves. Just look at what a marvel you are. So much is only possible because you can take a little and give it different arrangements. Just like the periodic table. Fundamentally, you have only so many different elements on the periodic table. But out of those elements, how many molecules must be there out there in the world? And almost an infinite number of molecules, right? But only, I can't remember how many elements are there in the periodic table anymore. Can someone remind me? Anyone? 108 stable ones. Okay. So 108 stable elements in the periodic table. How many molecules? About the same? Hundreds, thousands, millions, maybe billions of different types of molecule. How are so many different molecules possible? Different arrangements of the same elements. In the same way, the same is true about everything you see around you, ladies and gentlemen. This is only this, because there's energy in this form that exhibits this characteristic. If you could melt this, if you could heat it up enough, this will no longer contain this structure. There is a melting point. For any object, there's a melting point. Give it enough energy and this will lose this characteristic. How will it lose this characteristic? What's going to change when you start heating this and heat it up to its melting point? What's going to change? Arrangement, indeed. This structure is going to change. This form is going to change. When the form changes, what changes? Characteristics change. Then, is it the mug that has the characteristic? Or is it just energy in this form that exhibits the characteristic of holding water? First one or the second one? The second one. What is the difference between these two objects then? Form. That's it. And these two? Form. See, one can be used to write, the other can be used to do the exact opposite of it. The exact opposite of it. Can you believe it? One form of energy can undo what is done by another form of energy. The same energy. Simply because each form exhibits a different characteristic. The mistake that we make is we take objects for granted. We think that this is a pen, and a pen is a pen is a pen is a pen. And then we try and define the pen. So we first identify this as a pen, and then we try to list out its various characteristics. It can be used to write. It can be used to hold in this way. You can put it down. It can roll. It has a clip which you can take off and put back on. See, we think that these are characteristics of a pen. It's not. See, we think that it's a pen and nothing else. But the thing is this. This is not a pen and nothing else. This is just energy in this arrangement. Therefore, here's what happens next. If this is just energy in this arrangement, the moment the structure of that energy changes, the moment that energy takes a different form, now it will become anything else but a pen. It will become anything but a pen. But we are not prepared to see that happen. Why are we not prepared to see that happen? Because to us, this is a pen and nothing else. Therefore, here's where we set our expectations. I'll bring a mug. When we think of this as a pen and nothing else, now we have a whole list of expectations. Like it has to write. Have you never found yourself where you try to write with the pen and it doesn't write? And then you go... And then you try and write again and then you go... What, like that's going to make it write all of a sudden or something? What's with the sound effects? That is an exhibition of your frustration, isn't it? Yeah, why? Where is that frustration coming from? Here's the answer. Here's the answer. Where is the frustration coming from? The frustration is coming from the fact that you expect this to be a pen and nothing else. Therefore, a pen must always be able to do what? Write. But this is not a pen. This is just energy aggregated in a certain form. So whenever energy changes, whenever there are causes for that composition of energy to change, that arrangement of energy to change, that form to change, then immediately, not after, not soon after, not soon before, right then and there, characteristics change. Because this is not a pen to be able to write forever. Yeah, I mean, if this were a pen, it would forever write. Of course it would. If this were a pen, it would forever write. But this is not a pen. It is merely energy in this form. Therefore, when the energy changes, when there's a change in composition, when there's changes in its condensation, when there's some form of energy change, then those characteristics, perhaps one of these will no longer manifest. Because, ladies and gentlemen, these are characteristics not of a pen, but of forms of energy, not of a pen. Therefore, when this energy form changes, these characteristics, they change in response. But what do we think it is? A pen. And what's worse than that? And nothing else. Therefore, what you would expect of a pen, you'd always expect of this object. But unbeknown to you, little do you know that this is no pen at all. This is just forms of energy. So when energy composition changes, immediately, no sooner than that, no before, no sooner, characteristics change as a result. Actually, characteristics don't change. The current composition of energy demonstrates or exhibits or manifests whatever characteristic at that time. Because the concept of change does not really apply in Hetupala, I mean in cause and effect theory. But even if you put that to a side, the moment the form of energy changes, then the characteristic changes. How do you control the energy in this? Who controls the energy in this? What are the characteristics of energy? What are the characteristics of energy? You know it. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Anicca, dukkha, and anatta are the characteristics of energy. Meaning, energy has no bias, no preference. No, I have to be here, nor I have to go from here. I have to be somewhere else. None like that. No preferences, no biases. Energy always responds to a demand. Where there's a void, that's where energy will aggregate. That is the dukkha characteristic of energy. Only in response to a deficiency will energy respond, will aggregate. And then ultimately, energy never made anything. It never made an object. It never made an entity. All it was an accumulation, an aggregation of energy. That's all it was. It never created anything out of it. It never created a pen. It was just energy. But it manifested various characteristics because of its composition. Compositional differences resulted in characteristic differences. That is the anatta nature of energy. So if energy is all there is, that is what the Buddha taught us. He said the whole world has the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha and anatta. No wonder, because all there is energy. But we think that the world is nitya, sukha and atta. Meaning, we think that instead of thinking of it as energy, we think that this is a pen. This is not just a collection of energy. This is a pen. This is a pen. And therefore, we can expect certain things from this pen. Don't you expect certain things from a pen? Don't you? Like, such as, it must write. Otherwise, where do all those sound effects come from? Where does all that come from? When your car doesn't start, you have the same effect, sound effects. When you open the faucet and water doesn't come out of it, same sound effects. When you go home and the dishes haven't been washed, same sound effects. When the dog has done the dirty on the living room, in the living room on the sofa, then same sound effects. Why? Because it's, you don't expect that. Why expectations? Because you don't understand that all of this is merely energy and its compositions exhibiting various characteristics, and those characteristics are so transitive, or rather so transient. Those characteristics are so transient. They are merely manifestations of energy's compositions. The moment energy composition changes, the characteristics that are exhibited changes just like that. Therefore, you realize that there is no basis to set an expectation if you understand anicca, dukkha and anatta. But for as long as you see the world as being nitya, sukha and atta, meaning that there are entities and those entities exist, right? And that they're not based on causes. For as long as you see the world in that sense, you now start to build expectations on top of those entities. But please do try and understand, entities don't exist in the outside world. Entities are mere phantoms of your mind. You project the characteristics of entities onto compositions of energy. What are the characteristics of entities? Nitya, sukha, atta. These are the characteristics of entities. And where do entities exist? Only in your fantasies. They exist only in your mind. Out there are no entities. All there are compositions, aggregations of energy, which therefore represent or demonstrate, exhibit the characteristics of energy. That's the thing. Anything that is made of energy represents the characteristics of energy. Anything made of sugar tastes like what? Tastes sweet, right? Because it's made of sweet sugar. Likewise, anything that is made of energy, which is characteristically anicca, dukkha and anatta, will also exhibit the characteristics of anicca, dukkha and anatta. That made a lot of sense to me. Thank you. How much of that made sense to you? All of it? Some of it? None of it? Still trying to figure out what the heck this is all about? Did I get off the wrong bus halt? I admit, this is a little profound. Maybe not a little, maybe quite a bit. But, you know, here's the deal, right? I'll say this and we'll close for the day. Just this morning as we were driving in to Rajagiriya, I was talking with Sudha Sihandru. And I shared with him a miracle that I have seen in the sasana. This is a miracle to me. See, I explained to him. I said, Ape Handru ne. When a pratakjan does a meritorious deed, it earns them some amount of merit. A pratakjana, meaning someone who has no understanding of the Dhamma. It earns them some amount of merit. When a sotapanna individual does the same merit, it earns them, or the same activity, the same task, it earns them lots more merit. Lots more merit. And you could keep going up like that. So when the Sakrudagami individual or the Anagami individual does the same task, it earns them lots more merit. Up to the point where you are just about to become an Arahant. Not an Arahant, because an Arahant earns how much? They earn zero merit. They don't earn merits. They do good deeds, but they don't earn merits out of it. No ping is produced out of that. But just the moment before an Arahant, You do the same amount of the same task, the same activity, and you earn tremendous amounts of merits. Sometimes it might just be offering a flower, maybe offering a gilampasa, maybe laying down the pavada, maybe holding a mutukuda. Whatever the deed might be. See, because it all depends on your level of understanding of the truth. Because the higher up you go, the noble ladder, the less self you sense and feel. And therefore, the less self-centered that task is. The more self-centered the task is, remember we talked about dāne and dīma at the beginning? Yeah. So to truly be a dāne, you have to have seen the Dhamma. Without having seen the Dhamma, all you do is dīma, not dāna. Right? So the further you go up this noble ladder, you understand what I mean by a noble ladder, the various stages of enlightenment, the more merit you earn out of it. Then I said, think about the Bodhisattva of the Supreme Buddha, the Supreme Buddha Bodhisattva. See, the difference between him and us is we have the privilege and the good fortune to listen to a teaching from a teacher, the truth, the philosophy from a teacher, and leverage that understanding to amplify the merit power of whatever meritorious deed we do. Agreed? As an example, let's say today you come and do this floral decoration. Okay? So this is your first day and you help out to do that. You come back the following week after having listened to the first week's sermon. Having understood something about the Dhamma, the second time you come back, you do it with more joy, with more purpose, with more understanding. You do the same task, perhaps the same 15 minutes as you did the previous day, but you earn more merits out of it. Now fast forward a few weeks, let's just say one fine day, you actually click, you understand the Dhamma, and you become a Sotapanna. From that day on, you can now begin to leverage that understanding. And therefore, the same task you do keeps on magnifying, amplifying, because you leverage your understanding to a point where you can now do the same task but earn so much more merits than you previously used to. This opportunity is available to us, but it never was available to the Bodhisattva. It was not available to the Bodhisattva, to the Buddha. Why not? Because he didn't go through the stages of Sotapanna, Sakrutagami, Anagami, and Arahat. One moment he was a Prutakjana, the next moment he was a supreme enlightened Buddha. So we have the privilege of earning lots and lots and lots of merits in one lifetime to help us magnify the power of our merits. But he never had that opportunity. He was purely and completely reliant and dependent on his merits, but as a Prutakjana. Therefore, if you work out the sums, just imagine how much merit he must have had to accumulate, because there's no leveraging power. Yeah, which we have, but he didn't have. No leveraging power. You can't say, I am today a Sotapanna, therefore I can earn more merits. You can, but he couldn't. Therefore, all the merits that he needed to become a Buddha, he had to earn while still being a what? A Prutakjana. The merits needed to become a supreme Buddha, he had to earn while remaining a Prutakjana. How much time do you reckon that must have taken? Just work out the numbers. You know, we can try and become arahant because it requires a certain amount of merits to become arahant. But you don't immediately become an arahant, right? You get the stepping ladder. You can become a Sotapanna and leverage that to earn more merits. You can become a Sakrutagami, leverage that to earn more merits. Then you can become an Anagami and you learn lots more merit from the same task to help you become an arahant. But what did the poor Bodhisattva have? He was a Prutakjana right from the start till the end. Therefore, what he couldn't make up for through wisdom, he had to make up for time, labor, patience. That is why it took him so long to become a Supreme Buddha. That's why it's unimaginable, ladies and gentlemen, the amount of sacrifice that he must have made. I sometimes feel that he must have served every sentient being in this 10,000 world systems, either directly or indirectly, one way or the other, to earn enough merits to one fine day close his eyes and the entire realization of this whole universe to come to him just like that. Merits can do that. That's a miracle. Merits can do that. And then for someone to spend all that time earning all that merit without the added advantage of going through the stages of noble attainment to become a Supreme Buddha. That's why it's eons after eons after eons after eons. That's why they are said, they are called incalculable eons. You must understand the sacrifice made by your great father, by the great master, the great teacher. The Buddha is no ordinary being, ladies and gentlemen. He is no ordinary being. He is extraordinary in every sense of the word. Incomparable. That compassion is just incomparable. When he had every opportunity to attain arahathood at the feet of a previous Buddha, but then to sacrifice that and say, this is not what I want. If I become a Rahatan Vahanse today, then that will be my end of my suffering for myself. But there are so many other sentient beings who need this. Then it has to be, it is my task, O Lord, as you did once for us. It is my task to also go through that. So may the merit that I do today help me become that Supreme Buddha, was the resolve that he made at the feet of the Lord Deepankara. Just imagine. This is what becomes a paramita. That's why they are bodhisattva paramita, not just any old mundane paramita. That's why I help you to identify the difference between giving, dhimma, and dana. Very different things, ladies and gentlemen. Therefore, if it was merit that helped him to understand the Dhamma, to see through wisdom, then it's the same thing that's going to help you as well. It's not like the Buddha gets it for merit, we get it for something else. It's not that. There's only one thing you can exchange for comfort with this universe. So imagine there's a shop, there's a tuck shop in the universe, where you can go and buy all sorts of comfort, whether that is mundane physical comfort or psychological mental comfort, including Nibbana, right? You know the only thing they accept as payment, currency, merit. They accept nothing else at that shop. That's why it's crucial that you use every waking moment to earn as much merit as you possibly can. If this made sense to you today, that's because of your merit. As a teacher, I can help, but I can't understand this on your behalf. I can bring examples, I can bring props, I can bring metaphors and similes, and I can do all sorts. I can do a song and a dance here. But your understanding is your understanding. That miracle happened within you, not here. Seriously, that miracle happened within you. If you understood what I've just explained to you today, you know what you did? Sitting there, listening to me, watching all, looking at all this. What you did was exchange merit for understanding. That's what you did. Without even knowing that is what you were doing. You are exchanging merit for understanding, for comprehension, for wisdom. That's not a miracle that I did. That's your miracle. That's why I always urge you, live a life, live a meritorious life. Live a wholesome life. Live a good life. Don't worry about living the good life. Live a good life. Engage in as many meritorious deeds as possible, ladies and gentlemen. Don't skip a beat. Don't miss the opportunities, because one opportunity missed will never come back again. Whether that's parents, teachers, the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, make use of all these opportunities. If what's available right now is to help a poor man or a sick man cross the street, an old man cross the street, do it. You learn something out of it. When it comes to merits, be beggars. Trust me. When it comes to merits, literally behave like a beggar. Beggars are not choosers. When it comes to merits, literally be a beggar. Go looking for merits. Do as many as you can. That is not to steal one's opportunity to do merits. When someone else does it, look at it and rejoice in it. That is equally meritorious. That's the beauty of merits. As I do this sermon, if you think what I'm doing is a meritorious deed, trying to help people understand the Dhamma, rejoice in that. It doesn't have to be that you have to come and sit here and do the sermon. Rejoice in this good that we are doing all together. You and I, all of us together. If you see a gentleman holding the mutukude, it doesn't have to be you whose hand holds the umbrella. Hold it in your heart. Rejoice in it. Perhaps the gentleman who's holding the umbrella does not understand merit. Perhaps. But if you do, you rejoice in the merit. And perhaps one day you can spare a moment and explain to him, "Sir, do you know how meritorious what you're doing is?" When I first held a mutukude, I didn't know what the heck it was for. But someone later on explained it to me. Last week you were at the monastery. What did you do? Lots and lots of merits. You were taken all around the monastery. See, last week we offered a sanitary complex to the Anagarika Rama. None of us were the individuals who actually donated to it. But did you not have something to do while you were there? Was that a waste of time? But it was not your offering. Does that matter? Today, as I say it to you, even if you weren't there on the day, can't you still rejoice in it? There you go. That is the beauty of merit. It's always goodness in your heart. As your heart rejoices, you earn merits. When your heart resents, you earn demerit. So the power to your merit is always bestowed and always with you. See how empowered you are. See how much you are capable of. That's why you don't have to go begging, borrowing and stealing. You are very capable. Your Nibbana is yours, ladies and gentlemen. There's no one to get in your way to your Nibbana. No one to stop you. No one to hinder you. No one to impede you. Whatever you want to do when it comes to your Nibbana, you can do it. Your limit is the limit. So if you have no limit, there is no limit. So the video from last week? Video from last week? You want to see it? I don't have it today. I'll get it in for next week. So you can earn the same merit twice. And you can share it with your friends. People who care about you, people who are vested in your interest. Tell them, "See what I did last Sunday. See why I went to the monastery. Puta, dua, see I, Amma went to the monastery. Look at what she was able to do." And if they're happy for you, they want you to be happy, they want you to rejoice and they want you to earn merits, they will also rejoice in that. And invite them. "Puta, next time why don't you come with me? Dua, next time why don't you come with me?" We help ourselves by helping others. This community is the best example of that. I can't think of a better example than that, than this community, of how helping others is the best way to help oneself. This is the quintessential example of that. How by helping others we help ourselves. So, the extent to which you have understood today's talk is the extent to which you were actively exchanging merit for wisdom. Perhaps at one point you ran out of merit. Maybe that's when I held the mug up. Maybe it's when I put the pens in. Perhaps it was when I put the flowers in there. And then merits ran out. Nothing more to exchange for wisdom. From there on, you listen to a talk. It made logical sense. But what didn't happen was that logical sense, sight transforming into insight. That's okay. We have next week, and the week after, and the week after, until the last week. Either my last week or your last week. Until then, fight. 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 With whom? Of course, there's no other fight. Let's leave it there. Okay. Let us all take a moment, ladies and gentlemen, to transfer the merits that we have all learned today by inviting the Swami Mahasi to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma, by making offerings to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, by listening to the Dhamma, preaching the Dhamma, as well as contemplating the truths and making efforts to attain the bliss of Nibbana. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayaka Theras of all the chapters throughout the world, as well as all the monks and nuns throughout the world who practice the Dhamma. Let us also transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident to the monastery and the anagarikas and anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer this message to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, as well as our teachers, anyone and everyone who've helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this merits to our forefathers, our ancestors, loved ones who have passed away in our names, reminding ourselves that in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and live in peace and harmony. Let us transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends to us, acquaintances to us. They will have gone the extra mile on our behalf, and therefore with a sense of gratitude for all that they have done on our behalf, let us take a moment to transfer these merits to them. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May, by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may finally you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahatiranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sri Sambuddha Sasan itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatnva Dvesha ginnen midatnva Moha ginnen midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka Siyalu sattvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini Nivan sapa laveva Nivan sapa laveva Nivan sapa laveva
Tunduvange suvisi ananta maha guna belin Silu loka silu satyoma Nibbana parama sukhe sukhita taravetnva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.